This podcast represents the views of the hosts and not the University of Texas at Austin.
This is Policy on Purpose, a podcast produced by the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. We take you behind the scenes of policy with people who are shaping and have helped shape it. For more, visit lbj.utexas.edu/podcast. This month on the podcast, we're sharing a four-part series on our symposium, Policy, Leadership in the Age of AI, which was hosted at the Bass Lecture Hall on October 1st, 2024. As part of UT's 2024 initiative, The Year of AI, we brought together public, private, and academic leaders for crucial discussions on the ethical dimensions of AI technologies and public policy in its ever-evolving landscape. Our third episode covers the fourth panel of the day, AI in Teaching and Learning. This panel delves into ways to harness responsible AI use to drive teaching and learning outcomes. It was hosted by Julie Schell, Assistant Vice Provost of Academic Technology at UT Austin.
Good afternoon, everyone. Let's try that one more time. Good afternoon, everyone. All right. Thank you. Thank you so much. My name is Julie Schell. I'm the Assistant Vice Provost of Academic Technology and the Director of the Office of Academic Technology here at UT Austin. And I have the pleasure of moderating our panel today on AI in Teaching and Learning. Educators and higher education leaders gather to share in-depth insights into how institutions like UT Austin and our other institutions across the state are leveraging AI to enhance educational outcomes. I'd love to take the opportunity to introduce our panelists today. We have Michelle Singh here, Assistant Commissioner of Digital Learning at the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board. I've been working with Michelle for over about half a decade now on advancing our capacities for digital innovation and literacy on our Texas campuses. So I'm very excited to be here with her today. And I'd also like to introduce David Eaton, who's a professor of natural resource policy studies here at LBJ. I've had the pleasure of getting to know David over the past year, particularly around some exciting things that he's been doing with AI in his classroom. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us for our panel. So we're going to start off with just some quick introductions, and I will get us going with that. So right now, like other industries, AI is everywhere in education, K through 12 and higher ed. I opened the Chronicle last night to the technology section, as I would, given my role, and almost every article had the word AI in it. And so it really is everywhere right now. And when it comes to teaching and learning, it's also everywhere in terms of where people are at with it. So everyone is at different levels. Students, teachers, staff alike are all at different places. Some are AI curious, some are anti-AI, some are AI skeptical, some are AI innovative. It really ranges. I would say that I'm highly AI experimental. I teach a design pedagogy course, and right now I'm working on a lesson plan that's having students analyze output from generative AI, analyze and critique teaching philosophies. Remember having to write those statement of teaching philosophies? I have the students analyzing, critiquing AI-generated teaching philosophies for effective principles or not effective principles. So I would call myself AI experimental, and so I'm going to ask Michelle and David just to introduce themselves by reminding you of their name, their title, and their phrase, and where they're at in terms of AI readiness, and a little bit about why.
Well, I'll go ahead and go first. So hello, everyone. I'm Michelle Singh. As Julie mentioned, I proudly serve as your Assistant Commissioner of Digital Learning at the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board. Artificial intelligence and anything innovation, digital learning falls under my portfolio, including open education resources and all that entails the open agenda and the larger conversation. So we also get to work hand in hand with institutions as they navigate what is currently happening in higher education and prepare ourselves for what's coming next. And so if I had to pick a phrase to describe where I am, I would say AI open. on the sense that I am open-minded and really excited about what AI has the potential to do for higher education and teaching and learning, but also selfishly, because my other passion is open education, to really look at the convergence between open education principles and how they serve as that underlying foundation for the way that we're approaching artificial intelligence and emerging technologies in general. This collaboration, the spirit of sharing, this almost solidarity between sectors that hopefully will continue to expand and just become second nature to us as we move forward.
Thank you so much, Michelle. David, what about you? Where are you at and why?
Well, I'm Dave Eaton. I am Bess Harris Jones Professor of Natural Resource Policy Studies at the LBJ School of Public Affairs, University of Texas at Austin. I'm AI experimental, but also AI positive. I see that universities are going to be utilizing AI because and teaching AI because this is what the job market for all of our graduates are going to expect and require. And so I see that we need to just do a good job. But I'm experimental in that I've tried three different approaches to testing AI in the classroom over the past 9 months. In February, there was an undergraduate class here with 18 students from Hiroshima University who came to Austin to observe what was being done in large businesses utilizing AI and discussing AI and the use in the classroom and use in their potential work opportunities, and had a chance to be part of that class. In August, I was part of a class in Hiroshima, working with colleagues there, along with 50 graduate students from Purdue, Arizona State, UT Austin, and Hiroshima University, looking at applications of AI in large businesses that were using it, and also discussing how to use AI in the classroom and in the workplace. And then the case that you referred to is we had a class in the spring semester. We were actually using AI techniques to teach about AI. So it was really an opportunity to see how things worked in improving education. And in effect, my understanding has evolved a great deal by learning how companies and how governments actually use AI. And so I'll be talking about some of those things when we get to other questions.
Thank you so much, David and Michelle. And I'd love for the audience just to sort of check in with yourselves about where you're at. You know, are you AI experimental? Are you AI forward? Are you AI responsible? Any anti-AI folks in the room, AI skeptical? Just taking a check with yourself there. And then thinking about wherever you're coming from, if you're here at UT Austin or you're elsewhere, where you feel like your organization sits. I think here at UT Austin, I would put us in the AI forward, AI responsible realm. So really interested in pushing boundaries and opening up spaces in teaching and learning in particular, but also really wanting to do that in a highly responsible way. So I'll start off. We've been tossing around the term AI quite a bit, and one of the things that I think is really interesting about the concept is that the misconceptions that are attached to AI, and one of those big misconceptions that's quite prevalent is collapsing the term artificial intelligence into one umbrella term. So equating all AI with what's newer to the market right now and what we've all been sort of talking about and what's really the hot topic, which is generative AI tools like ChatGPT. And while generative AI and ChatGPT and OpenAI are really the talk of the town right now, there are many, many, many different types of artificial intelligence. And collapsing all those definitions can be problematic. There's machine learning, there's conversational AI, there's deep learning, there's algorithms, there's large language models, there's diffusion models, natural language processing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And when you stop to think, if someone asks you, what's the difference between Siri and Alexa and ChatGPT, you can start to, if you don't have a real clear understanding of the differences and how those are trained or what their purposes are, you can see that definitional clarity is a little bit wonky. I promise this is my longest preamble. But a really important policy problem, I think, around the definitional clarity issue came up in April, and this is in our sort of K through 12 policy land, where there was a headline in a reputable Texas newspaper that read, "Texas will use computers to grade written answers on this year's STAR tests. The state will save more than $15 million by using technology similar to ChatGPT to give initial scores, reducing the number of human graders needed. The decision caught some educators by surprise." So what really worried me about this headline is that human-calibrated assessment tools like are used to grade the STAR test are not like ChatGPT. They're dramatically different mechanisms. They're not generative AI tools. And it would be highly problematic if we were grading students' STAR tests, essays, using generative AI tools. This caused quite an uproar and a lot of confusion. And so I'll start off here with David. As an educator, how do you start to personally untangle all of these different definitions, and why might it be important to do so?
Well, I'm glad you gave that preamble. Now I'm on. I'm glad you gave that preamble, because I think that is an important element that we need to discuss. Because my observation is the bulk of the applications of AI are having to do with machine learning. The companies that are doing it, that's primarily what they're doing. And this case of the STAR exam is really auto-grading by machine based on human documented calibration. And I see that as quite parallel to what has been done in the past, with actually some advantages over what's been done in the past. Because when you have a large number of human beings, you've got a very small number of examples that have been graded, and then those individual human beings are grading it, you've got some issues with respect to transparency and consistency. When you have a capacity with to be able to check over these new STAR exams, not only with one example, but multiple examples of human-initiated evaluation. In fact, you can have multiple parallel scoring of the STAR exam, and you, in fact, can get some consistency and transparency from it. So I see that not only is this faster and less expensive, but it may be more thorough and more fair to the people that are involved, because you can do multiple rounds of assessment rather than hoping that that single faculty member that reads that single exam, will they not have a bias that may show up in their assessment of that exam? So I see the idea, because you can do things in parallel and multiple times, that in fact, and of course this can always be double-checked by humans at the end, it really has an opportunity to do a better job of assessment and is more fair to the students. It can be more fair to the students, and it can be much more comfortable for the assessors.
Yeah, and I think that and when we say it, we're talking about machine learning. We're not talking about generative AI.
Right.
And I think that those are important distinctions. Michelle, how important is it to understand the different types of artificial intelligence when it comes to policy making and determining the kinds of tools that we're going to use to foster our educational environments?
Well, so there's multiple levels, right? So personally, it's really important for us to be able to distinguish between these, because we are the ones that are in charge of our own journey, right? We're the ones that are implementing within our classes. When it comes to the policy piece, we have to remember that different technologies afford us the ability to meet different task needs. Is it transactional, where you just want a back and forth, an input and output, or is it more to utilize in the transformational sense? And this is very much a la Julie Schell in conversations that we've had before. That understanding the distinct capabilities of each is such a critical piece, so that we ourselves are prepared for our level of engagement and our type of engagement. The policy part that's critically important is to allow for that flexibility within what is stated as a guiding framework or as a conceptual framework that allows us to be creative enough to understand and do a deep dive into each technology for whatever is best suited for the task at hand. Right now, there is an influx of innovation, everything from I need something for my calendar, I need something to add color to my calendar, I need something to be able to connect my 5 calendars, I need something that's going to be able to share my calendar with my entire family, I need something that's going to, and go on and on and on, all around the calendaring task. And I didn't know that word, but just ask the younger students in class and they will give you a whole list of definition of words you don't understand. That's an AI on its own in that sense. But it's critically important to understand the different capabilities and the function that these different types of AI can bring to your teaching, can bring to students' consumption of knowledge, because that way you can tailor your own experience and you don't get lost in the technology, because that's one of the critical pieces. We have to be confident, we have to be comfortable as faculty to be able to engage at the level that we will gain the most out of that interaction and experience.
And I think for me, as the person who is sort of charged with making policy around AI use here at UT Austin, really understanding, if you're looking for a place to start, really understanding with what the definition of generative AI is and how it works really helped us forge paths and decide how we were going to handle AI policy on campus. So for example, we make it clear that we do not think that we if we could prohibit it, we would. So we firmly come down on that a faculty member should never input a student's work and then ask AI to generate feedback on that work and then hand off that output to the student as if it was their own. As seductive as that might sound, we really, for all intents and purposes, bar that kind of behavior, because we do believe that a human in the loop on that respect is very important, but that is very different, qualitatively different from auto scoring. So I think those distinctions are really important. Also, when you understand that the way in which generative AI is trained and how it functions, you know that the goal of something like ChatGPT, when you input a prompt and it produces produces output, that output is considered novel output. Output that didn't exist before. It might look like it did because it's pulling on words that existed before and putting those together through predictive text. But that output is new, novel content. And when you understand that definition, then you can make decisions like not using AI detectors on campus for academic integrity pursuits. Because, for example, here at UT Austin, we do use Turnitin for plagiarism. Okay, we do use the Turnitin tool to look for plagiarism in student writing, because what Turnitin is doing on the plagiarism side is that it's looking for content that existed before that the student is passing off as their own. AI detectors are just not as good. They're getting better, but they're even OpenAI turned off their detector because they said it's just too easy to fake it out. And we think that just one false positive on that kind of a case creates too much cost. And so really understanding that definition, if you're looking for a place to start in engaging with generative AI around teaching and learning and policymaking, I think really understanding what generative AI is and how it differs from these other types of AI can guide you to effective policymaking decisions. So, and I'll close it up there and move into our next question. So digging in a little bit here on the generative AI front a little bit more, one of the things that absolutely fascinates me with generative AI is how paradoxical it is. So generative AI, as a learning scientist, I love it because it literally can teach me almost anything, right? Literally. But it can also teach me really bad information or false information, misinformation, and disinformation, right? It can help spark your creativity, but it can also make you sound like everybody else. and it can give your creative voice away to other people, right? It can speed up your work, but it can also make you really sloppy. So there's quite a few paradoxes when it comes to generative AI. So Michelle, I'll start this question off with you. How can state level and institutional policy help faculty and students determine when AI should be used for teaching and learning and when it shouldn't?
And so I would be cautious in saying that a policy should ever drive how instructors utilize AI or any other emerging technology, because it's such an individualistic decision. It is such an individual ability to gauge your comfort level, to gauge where you are, what resources you have at your disposal to be able to be informed on what is out there, to be supported in your engagement in any emerging technology. But what I do strongly believe is that policy should be focused on acceptable use and setting those guidelines for operation. Also, really cognizant of the fact that the AI that we have today is not going to be the AI that we have 6 months from now. I mean, if you look at your news strands at this point, look at LinkedIn, everything is coming out every day, something new is. So what we're designing right now should really be about this larger concept, and what the coordinating board has really focused on is this adapting to innovation framework, where we are looking at the larger landscape of the university setting and identifying what we've already lived through, the fundamental lived experiences that we just recently overcame. I'm sure several of you remember the pandemic and what that did for us, that quick pivot into an environment that we were probably not all prepared for, this 100% immersion in this new type of delivery of instruction with probably not the most adequate resources or the ones that we wanted to be optimal in the way that we approached our work, and really leaning into what did we learn from that? What did we keep telling ourselves needed to change to build a more robust framework for what comes next? This adapting to innovation concept that the coordinating board is pushing is really centered on three different areas of focus, which includes governance, operations, and practice and pedagogy, with our stakeholders at the center of everything, our staff, our students, our faculty, our community, and our industry. And all of it is on a foundation of change management principles. We're talking about change. All of this is rooted in change theory, but also consistently looking at the landscape that is already out there. We have the fortune of going out to different institutions and seeing what is actively happening at all of our campuses, community colleges, universities, university systems, health-related institutions. And we continually, for the first month or so, heard, we've built a new committee. We now have a committee that's going to be dedicated to talk about AI, and we have a new committee. And while that is amazingly wonderful, our question was, did you have an existing academic technology forum? Did you have an existing committee looking at information technology? Did you have these pieces? And once you dig deeper into those conversations, the answers are usually, well, this committee, this other committee, and an additional one all have pieces related to this. So our follow-up question was normally, and did we engage those three existing committees that are well-versed in their work to develop this new committee? And unfortunately, the answer several times was no, because this is brand new. And so what we really are trying to get with this concept is, let's trust the fact that we have some policies, some protocols in place. We have infrastructure that is in place. Several institutions have Grammarly or already had contracts with different software systems that now have AI capability. Instead of trying to start from scratch on something new, why not start where we're at? And why not really dig into being proficient and optimizing those types of softwares? In addition, institutional agility has to be a topic of conversation that is aligned with business strategy. This can't just be an academic conversation. It cannot just be something that lives in academic affairs. It has to be something that is infused into all levels of university operation. And so we're really trying to make sure that our institutions are aware of the magnitude of this conversation and where it needs to be at. But rest assured, Texas is in a good place. We did a 2024, we did a landscape analysis of all of our Texas institutions. We had a pretty strong response rate, and out of the respondents, 84% of our institutions stated they were already in development or had developed policies and guidelines for practice and for programs. And out of those, 72% expressed they wanted to work with other institutions in the state of Texas. They didn't want to have to reinvent the wheel. They wanted to know what their partner institutions down the street were doing, what the community college that was a feeder school was doing, what people outside of Texas were doing. And that is the Texas advantage and what's going to take us into this next level that we're going to go into.
Thank you, Michelle. And talking a little bit about acceptable use, David, what are some of the use cases that you had in your own classroom, and how do you help students decide what is acceptable use of generative AI and what isn't?
Well, what is interesting is generative AI is really immaterial to a lot of what the applications are. Machine learning is what the companies are using, both in Austin and in Japan. Everybody and all the startups, they're all using machine learning. And that is really the bulk of what is being done. And to the degree that there's other stuff, it really has to do with speeding up the role of the internet for things that we have done already, and we're just automating and speeding it up. So the generative AI, I'm sure that this will take a larger and larger role. But in the observations in real classrooms and real use, it was much more. I'll give you some illustrations. Okay, just as an illustration, one of the most impressive use of machine learning in Japan was the company called Satake, which is a Japanese company that controls over 90% of the quality control for rice and other grains to assure that what people buy in the marketplace is very high quality grain without much mistakes in the grain or problems with it. And it was remarkable to understand that they are doing machine learning from a tiny number of pictures. 100 pictures at the visible wavelengths, 100 at infrared, 100 at X-ray, and that they're marrying with robots to be able to scan a very high volume of seeds, whatever kind it is, in order to throw out through the use of air systems. They throw out the seeds that aren't good. So it's really machine learning and very high speed. And that is their use of, that's their business plan. That's how they've captured the market. And this is very similar to so many of the other AI applications that we found. We had a number of students that got jobs this past summer in Japan working with startups that are AI startups, and they're almost all machine. They are all machine learning. So that was shocking to me to see that was most important. Now, the applications that we had in the class itself, when we were teaching AI and using AI, what I began to recognize is the things that we are doing, that we did in the class, were really things that had been done in the old days. They were just done faster and better today. For example, this was a class, if it's hard to imagine, we had students in Japan and the United States speaking two languages, interacting about AI, and having a real-time discussion in two languages in which there's simultaneous translation in English and Japanese, so they can see and they can discuss all the issues themselves. Now, this was amazing, okay? It so improved the quality of the classroom, because some of you may know, Japanese are typically in the classroom are very quiet and don't say much. We had undergraduates who had no experience with virtual international education. They were very active because they could see what was going on. They could see in Japanese what the Americans were saying. And so had a very robust conversation about AI and its applications. And it's all done with this very high speed simultaneous translation. The other thing that was going on is that we also were having summaries of the discussion being simultaneously generated in Japanese and in English. But this is also something that is not new, okay? And so here, this was providing a context to what was going on. So I view what my experience has really been, that a lot of the applications are things that have been done. They're just automated and better than in the past. And the issues of generative AI, even in these applications, they didn't really arise. So I'd be interested to hear of folks where the generative AI is really fundamental to the learning.
Mm-hmm. I think that's very helpful. Thank you. To hear the different examples that you were using in your classroom. I think one of the questions that I've gotten recently from students is that, actually this came from student governance in the last week, Professor Schell has this policy about AI, Professor Singh has this policy, and Professor Eden has this policy, and they're all different. We don't know quite how to navigate all of those different policies. So students not being able to sort of make sense of when they can use it, when they can't use it, if they can use it in one classroom or they can't, and they can't use it in another classroom, how do they start to make sense of this? And I think this is important because national surveys of college students reveal that most students, the large majority of students, expect their institutions, so their colleges and universities specifically, to ready them for AI in the workplace, with their top priority being teaching students the ethics of using AI. So if we're not exposing them to generative AI use in the classroom, we're also not exposing them to helping make decisions and how to engage with AI responsibly. What are some of the durable skills that learning to use generative AI or other types of AI responsibly can build for our graduates? David, what do you think about that? What are some of the durable skills, lifelong skills that engaging with AI in the classroom can build for our students?
Well, I see this as when I was a high school student in the 1960s, only the people who were nerds worked with computers, and we had to go down to a university and do key punching of cards and had lots of problems with getting those accurate. By the 1990s, everybody in college was using computers, and they were using their laptops or their other machines and utilizing things, and this became an absolute necessary part of higher education because all businesses needed to have that use. Well, I view AI and the many different kinds of AI and generative AI as something that all businesses, nonprofits, government agencies are all going to expect people to know, understand, and be able to be used and be comfortable. That these are in effect, this is an extension of this march of technology in which we are improving efficiency and accuracy, et cetera, through the use of AI tools. I have a brother who's a physician who has been using AI for the last couple of years. And he told me that he has improved the efficiency of his operation by more than 25% by using it. So I see that in almost any way of life, being able to do the variety of things that go under the rubric of AI, but in fact are very different, that the skills, the understanding, the comfort, the being able to function, that this is something that our students are going to need. And the particular skills that a person would have, if somebody's going into a big business, machine learning may be sufficient. But if someone is going into being a physician, the generative AI is really going to play a very important role in terms of screening for potential risks that will speed up the judgment that the physician can finally make. So I guess the punishment will fit the crime.
Michelle, what do you think are some of the durable lifelong skills that engaging with AI in the classroom responsibly can build for our graduates for the future?
Well, and again, I take it back to the fundamental skills of digital literacy, digital engagement, conversations we've been having for quite some time. Those of you that have been in the online space and enhancing your instruction with technology understand that students may be surrounded by technology, but that's a very different concept than learning from technology and learning with technology. And so going back to those fundamental digital information literacy skills, but also just cognitive skills, right? Complex thinking, critical thinking skills. We're starting to see these AI adjacent skills, which include data privacy information, cybersecurity, digital accessibility, those skills also coming up. And then these new fun ones like digital collaboration, knowing how to connect with others in a digital space, human-AI interaction. Also, these fun things called digital charisma, which I feel that I have a lot of charisma in person. I don't know how we're going to translate that into the digital environment, but it really is giving people the opportunity to explore new skills. As a state and as a nationwide perspective, several states are, we're having this national conversation about potentially missing the marker on this. Several states are investing in infrastructure development and research when it comes to AI. Take New York State, for example, just invested $275 million into Empire AI, which is their ability to work collaboratively with their institutions to build frameworks for development in artificial intelligence. There's other states as well that are doing very similar activities. But what we're not seeing as much are these centers or these initiatives that are really trying to promote professional learning, reskilling, upskilling for individuals. Who is training the individual to engage with all of these new technologies? Who is training individuals on how to assess what is a quality product that you want to invest the limited time that you have in exploring? What are those responsible parameters, ethical parameters? That conversation is the larger national conversation right now. How are we together starting to talk about the way that it is going to, it's going to need all of us to keep the human in the loop, to keep that relationship so that it doesn't get lost and keep the human in control. Because in essence, we are the ones driving. Human intelligence created artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence is designed to augment human intelligence. We can have this conversation all day going back and forth. I can already see some of us. But it is important to remember that as students as well, because we're all learning, there's a sense of solidarity that we need to keep in mind, that we need to keep ourselves at the center of the conversation.
I think that's right. And I personally, I don't think AI presents our graduates and our students with a challenge of their lifetime. I think dealing with ambiguity is the challenge of our students' lifetime and learning how to navigate situations responsibly and with ethical frameworks when they're faced with misinformation, when they're faced with all of these paradoxes that I mentioned. Is it cool to engage with generative AI when we know how many environmental resources that it's taking? How do we know when, how important is it to teach students about the implicit bias that's baked into generative AI? Is it okay to upload someone else's work to get help with studying if it doesn't go anywhere else? These are all very ambiguous questions. I know for myself personally, in my class, I have a lesson where I'm kind of AI agnostic. Students can use AI or they cannot use AI. It's sort of up to them, but the assignment requires them to generate an image either through their own design or they could use generative AI. And in the syllabus, it very clearly states the policy that if they're going to use generative AI, they do need to cite that they use generative AI. And I provide an example. We talked about it on the first day of class. I got an assignment from a student that had a really incredible graphic, and it didn't have a citation. So I assumed that the student did it themselves. And so I gave feedback on how effective I thought that the graphic was. And the student replied, oh, I use generative AI to do that. I was really surprised. I was really surprised that happened. And what I realized in that moment is that even with clarity, there's still ambiguity around this. And I really viewed that as an opportunity to have a conversation with the student and understand that these aren't 1-0 situations. And if I can help my students learn about what was problematic about that and engage them in developing these ethical frameworks for themselves, I feel like that's a durable skill for the future. And so I do think that being able to deal with ambiguity, learning to engage with AI really helps you do that effectively, and that is a lifelong skill that will be very beneficial to them for the workforce. And kind of aligned with this topic, I read a study that came out in December from the ACT. Anybody remember taking that ACT? Or kids take that ACT, right? That indicated that the majority of high school students report that their teachers disallow them from using generative AI for homework. So, and I have done quite a bit of work with one of our central school districts, Waco ISD, around generative AI. And one of the things we do see in K-12 is that teachers are consistently more concerned about generative AI use in their classrooms than higher ed, although higher ed is also concerned. So the teachers are not letting students, the majority of these students said the teachers were not letting them use generative AI for their homework due to concerns about academic integrity and cheating. But in that same study, the ACT also reported that AI tool use was significantly related to students' academic achievement. So students who had higher ACT composite scores were more likely to use AI tools. Okay, so one question I have is, in higher education, as institutions and as educators, are we widening the achievement gap if we ban AI tool use in our classrooms? And Michelle, I'll start off with you on that one.
Well, this is certainly a complex question, and one that I think we can wrestle with for a very long time. There's always two sides to the coin, right? And we know that. I want us to think for an instance on, and I'm going to keep going to our past just to build confidence. So full disclosure, I have a computer science degree and a counselor education degree, so yay to random education pathways, because it's really benefiting me now. So you'll constantly hear me going back to this idea of fear and the emotions that get tied to this. But if we look back when we were thinking about web conferencing, right? And so when we first were introduced to Zoom, and I love that now Zoom has become synonymous with web conferencing, and it's like Kleenex and tissues. Zoom is a form of a company, not web conferencing, which is actually the function of it. But everybody says, let's Zoom, I'll send you a Teams link, and that's always very entertaining. But when we think about web conferencing, when we first started to see this come up in institutions, it was, again, a hit or miss. You were able to adopt it at will, depending if you wanted to do this in your class. Different colleges took it. Different departments thought, we're going to do this holistically. Others thought, no, we're not going to engage in that right now. There was a lot of very similar conversations happening. What we started to see from the student side was that the more that students engaged in these types of web conferencing scenarios, the more they were able to train themselves on how to best represent themselves and their skill set. Behind this new screen that now, you only see this side of people's faces, and really being able to present yourself in a manner that was engaging within the time frame that you had to make an impression with people that were going to hire you. Back then, I know that I did a lot of phone interviews when I was first starting out in my career. And so you had all your notes, or not that we had notes, but you had notes, or you had the post-its that would spark some idea in you to answer a question. All of a sudden you introduce video, that's a little different. I needed to start stretching a little bit more, place things strategically to be able to see that. But all of that took training. The more that students were able to have these conversations in a safe environment with exercises and projects within their classes, the more they were able to hone in their skills so that they could go through round 1, 2, potentially 3 in this Zoom atmosphere, this web conferencing atmosphere, to be able to be invited to a campus or to an institution, to a future industry place of employment, that they could then demonstrate what they've been practicing with one-to-one face-to-face interaction. And so I say this because a lot of this is that same way of practicing skills for our students. They want environments that they can ask questions, that they can build their skill, that they can gain a level of comfort and gain a level of confidence in an environment with a guide. At the same time, the more that we engage with these types of artificial intelligence, the more proficient and comfortable we get as faculty. One word of caution, though, that I definitely do say is we have to remember, while AI and any type of emerging technology, innovation for institutions is commendable at all levels. We appreciate the enthusiasm and the innovation that is happening. One of the things we consistently hear from students as we travel, as I mentioned, is they're very grateful for the work that we did going back to the pandemic. But one of the biggest hurdles that they had was they are one student. And an entire university setting, being innovative and designing new operational mechanisms, new technologies, introducing new AIs and new apps is a lot to handle for one person. And so one of the students actually said it best when they said, one semester, I had to deal with 35 different applications in the residence halls, in food service, in health, in tutoring, in my regular academic work. And I don't know whether I was coming or going. And I didn't just have to learn how to use the technology. I had to learn how to learn from it, and I had to learn my craft, what I was studying, so that I could apply it. And that was completely overwhelming. So while, again, I think it's important to continue to introduce these when we're all ready to do so, but we need to keep in mind that we have a singular customer that the entire university is working for. So conversation and collaboration are critically important.
David, anything you'd like to add on that?
Well, this brings me back again to high school. Where we were not allowed to use calculators in high school. And now, you know, what child in third grade is not going to use a calculator? Where now we have in middle schools, a lot of them are saying you can't bring a cell phone to class. Okay, we will have these restrictions that are distractions that occur in schools. But the die is already cast. Okay, in effect, folks are going to be facing, just as they're facing, all of these apps and different kinds of social media. They're going to be dealing with that in the same way they've had to deal with all the different softwares. You know that they've got to do word processing, and in three classes they have three different software for word processing. Folks are going to become comfortable in learning how to learn and being able to use this. But the die is cast because the society is moving on. The society is going to accept generative AI, and eventually there'll be ways of dealing with the ethical questions that these things are going to come up. Those ambiguities are going to be addressed in the workplace, that is a much more effective place for it to be addressed than in a university. One of my comments about university and ethics is in universities, we don't do a good job of teaching ethics. Okay, we don't have that as a structured class. We're not really finding ways to enable our students to, in a structured way, deal with those ambiguities. That doesn't that often occur. And I don't know why that's the case, but I think that just as we can observe in real life that ethical problems end up causing consequences to people in real life, I think that the generative AI and any other applications where people are representing work that's not theirs as their own, eventually these things, there'll be processes that address it. So, but I think the horse is out of the cart. All these things we're going to be using, and it'll be in class, it'll be in elementary and secondary schools soon.
I think something that's interesting about the 70s when calculators became popular is that it's actually math pedagogy was revolutionized. And it was math teachers and math educators that really radically changed the approach to math teaching. And there were some people that really stood firm on the need to be able to do long division by hand. And slowly, math pedagogy just changed. And it's very different today than it was then. And I think that we have some real opportunities to think about how to shift to make teaching more interactive and more engaging instead of just sort of that passive engagement that is too common in our classrooms. Opportunities to give students real problems that they're motivated to solve and kind of move away from things that they can do asynchronously without us. So I think there's some real opportunities for pedagogical revolution there. And when it comes to banning, I'm actually not opposed to an individual academic choice to ban AI in their classroom, but I think we need to know why. And we need to have clearly articulated learning outcomes for our students. What do we want them to know and be able to achieve, and why would using AI inhibit that? And we need to articulate that justification to our students. And if we truly understand what we want our students to know and be able to do, after they finish learning with us, together with us, and we can articulate that, then I think it's okay to say, look, you wouldn't want, my boss always says, if you have to shoot free throws, you don't want somebody else shooting the free throws for you, to practice shooting the free throws for you. So we need to help students understand and motivate them and articulate our learning outcomes clearly and then explain why using AI would get in the way of that. And I think if we do that, we engage in a trusting relationship with them that they buy into for the most part. So
I've got one more comment I'd like to make. Certainly at the graduate level, the outcomes from use of generative AI for constructing text, it's generally not going to be adequate for it to be at a level consistent with what is expected as deliverables from the students to the instructor. And a student is going to be very surprised when their assessment of their work is really not up there, because it really it's not nuanced and thoughtful. And most instructors can figure that out. And I think, again, that these are things that will work out in practice, that eventually students are going to learn that they have to, looking at the assessment of the scores, there may need to be a human that goes over those things to confirm it, that the student needs to go over their own work to be able to say something that is adequate and sophisticated and thoughtful enough to be the kind of deliverable that they are expecting of themselves.
Yeah, and David, I love that point, and I see people from my team here right now who will roll their eyes at me when I say this, because I remind them of this all the time. But AI is good, but it's not as good as you are, and we really need to help our students understand that. It might have a larger database than you do. It might be faster than you are. It might be better at summarizing than you are, for sure. But it's not you, and it doesn't have your expertise, and it doesn't have access to your models that you've developed over time in your life, in your experience. And you can always, it does pull that out. It does pull that out of the output. So we really always do. We want to hear our students' voice, and they need to hear that from us. They do need to hear that from us, right? I want to see them. I want to hear from them. I do see that we have a couple folks who might want to ask some questions. So maybe we can finish up with this sort of last question here. Michelle, I'll hit you with this one. Not hit you, but...
Please don't.
So one of the things that happens at institutions, this is happening here at UT, is that we have world-renowned experts on AI. We have world-renowned teachers. There's a lot of innovation happening in AI and teaching and learning that's happening both at scale and in silos. So independent innovation is the bread and butter of a place like UT Austin, but when it comes to generative AI, independent innovation can also create risk. So from your balcony view at the Higher Education Coordinating Board, what infrastructure needs to be in place and established policy-wise and governance-wise to support sustainable and scalable AI for teaching and learning?
So I think we've covered a lot of these different pieces in pockets, right? So just to reiterate what we've talked about, there has to be an ethical framework for operation. There has to be data governance, data privacy, all of these different AI adjacent conversations that need to have. We need to take this away from only addressing artificial intelligence and really leaving it more technology agnostic so that we can pivot quickly whenever something comes up, that we can react a little bit faster. Not to say that educational institutions take longer than other industry partners do when it comes to change on campus, but we do have to provide a framework within policy that allows us to address the changes a little faster. If we don't, then we're going to be responding to ChatGPT 4 when ChatGPT 1000 is in place. And so we want to make sure that we're able to do those things. The bigger focus needs to be on designing a quality experience for students. And that's really the center of all of our conversations is what do we need to create for students to gain the most out of their time with us and be able to be career ready when they leave our institutions. And so one of the biggest pieces that I think we need to probably visit more often than we do at times is instead of just designing frameworks or policies with the student in mind, design with the student. Design alongside those individuals that we are charged with educating. Design alongside with them because they're involved in this to some degree, but they also need to clarify what their expectation is for their learning experience and the degree to which they want to see this. And I've been guilty of this many times in my classes. I'm excited about a technology. I'm excited about what it does for me and how it can simplify what I'm doing. And then all of a sudden you stop and have that honest feedback with your students and they say, this is wonderful. Was it necessary for the class? Not necessarily. It was great to enhance and it was really fun. But, and that's just one of those realities that we need to prepare ourselves for. The good thing is that I can say when it comes to Texas faculty, and this is to everyone's, compliment everyone in the room, is that Texas faculty are really leading in this space when it comes to AI optimism and the frequency of utilization. And this is based on a national survey that was just done by Bayview Analytics on OER and innovation. We were the top ranked in both of those categories, optimism and utility, ahead of Florida, New York, and California. We also ranked lowest in concern for AI implementation, and that was attributed to awareness conversations, events like this, and more than anything, the digital community that exists in our institution and then levels up to the Texas digital community. And so we have a strong support network, lean into that for sure. But just you know, remember that our student is our number one customer. This has to be part of a business strategy. There is a return on investment and we have to figure out how to measure that as well so that we can have our outcomes display the importance of the effort we're placing in. Financially, this is not an easy undertaking. This is a significant cost for institutions. And at what cost for the other things that an institution wants to accomplish. So all of these pieces have to be baked in to the larger university strategy. So no pressure whatsoever.
Thank you so much, Michelle and David. We'd be thrilled to take some questions from the audience.
I've got a microphone.
Go ahead and...
Okay, it'll get passed around.
Yep.
Well, thanks so much. That was really, really a fascinating discussion, and I really appreciated how you talked about AI and teaching and learning in terms both of the discontinuities the technology has brought and also the continuities. And with that in mind, I wanted to ask you about the relationship between AI as it's arriving on campus and what's happening with data on campus. Because, of course, AI is made from data and makes data. And there have been vast changes in the data landscape over the past 10, 20 years with, obviously with things going online, becoming computational. But I think about questions like FERPA, right? Like, you know, what are we allowed to do with data as teachers, as students, intellectual property? If we co-design with students in the age of AI, you know, who owns what we've designed? And, I'm really wondering how y'all are thinking about what need to be our best practices vis-a-vis data in this era, so that especially we don't end up in a situation where the student may be a customer, but of course if they don't own their data, then they're the product, right?
Sure. Sure. So I can start with a little bit about how we're thinking about this right now. And we do have, all students and all faculty and all staff do have access to Microsoft Copilot. If you sign in with your EID, then you can be sure that the Microsoft is an OpenAI not going to digest the data that you put into it to train their model. So I think being really clear about the kind of data that you can put into the model, and there is actually a link. If folks are interested, feel free to email me and I'll find it for you. This link I don't know off the top of my head, but we do have a link that lists the kind of data that you can put into the different models that we have. If it's public published data that is freely accessible and not behind some kind of password, you can put it into one of the other models. But we do recommend you sign in with your EID to Microsoft Copilot, so that you are protected behind a university contract where they literally sign that it is a contract violation if we do something insecure with your data. So that's one thing for the larger point of view here at UT. And I'm not sure if I think a lot of the questions that you ask actually are gray areas. And so I think we need to do that in conversation with our students to figure out where's our sweet spot on the ethics of what we input, what we take out, and how we transform that.
So read your use policies and your privacy policies for any technology that you engage with. Just a friendly PSA in case those of you that are LinkedIn users may have noticed within your threads that LinkedIn opted people automatically in to train their AI models. If you have not gone in to not allow that, that's probably something you should do if you are comfortable with that. But those types of situations, that's also a skill that our students need and we need, is to be looking at those user agreements, not to say that everyone doesn't just say, I accept, and moves on to the next step so as to not waste time. It's worth the time. It's worth the time to look through all of those things so that you are in charge of your data and you know where it's going and so forth.
Well, this is a issue of long origin, having data being developed by students, by faculty. We have policies at the university and at the university system for dealing with this. And frankly, I'm very comfortable with those policies. I'm delighted that any data that are developed in my classes by myself or my students are owned by the regents of the University of Texas system, because that in effect protects folks against misuse of that information. It's really the misuse that would be concerning for me, that is someone else able to make use of some data that's developed for some particular reason? And I'd rather have that be protected by a system that has plenty of attorneys to deal with it. But I don't know that that addresses your concern.
And I'll tie that up in a neat bow by saying that if there are legitimate educational use cases where you would want to put FERPA protected data into a generative AI tool, and I can think of some, and I'm sure that many of you have other use cases. There are tools; they're not free, but there are versions of Microsoft Copilot 365 on campus where they do allow FERPA protected data to be uploaded, and you're protected if you do that. If you had a particular pedagogical use case that you really needed to do that, there are ways for you to do it. It's not free, but there are ways for you to do it. Feel free to reach out to me if you want to do that.
Hi, thank you so much for this panel. I have a couple of questions. You can answer what you want. But some of this conversation, I think, is reflective of educators who have some level of comfort with the technology. And I think we all saw that during the pandemic, we initially struggled with educators that had that did not have comfort with Zooming or Teamsing. See, it just doesn't sound as good it's when you say that.
It doesn't.
And so, and they had to quickly learn to gain those skills. And I think when we see in the K-12 level, I think is some level of educators not themselves understanding the technology. Mm-hmm. And just what you, David, described, you have a level of understanding here of the nuances of what is quote-unquote AI. And I wonder, and so I, a lot of this symposium today does revolve around public trust, right? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, there is a question to me what you believe is the responsibility of the tech firms to spend more time explaining their technology and gaining public trust. There is a question I have for all of you as policymakers and educators, and maybe this is a little bit more on the K-12 level, and we're talking a little bit more here on higher ed, but which would be, we haven't talked a lot about how AI can level the playing field for out of reach, you know, schools and for educators who don't have the same resources. And is this a tactic that we want to see in our state, right, be more deliberately deployed? But it comes back down to, will anyone use it, right? And what is the trust level there? And will the parents just absolutely say no? Mm-hmm. And so, like, there's just so many parts to that strategy. But I think it starts out with, do we even think that there's a place for that?
Mm-hmm. I definitely think there's a place for that. And I'll say that people will only use it if they have the self-efficacy that they can successfully engage. So if they don't have the belief that they can successfully engage with generative AI, then they're not going to use that. And that starts with teacher professional development and educator professional development. So I do think, I don't necessarily think that tech firms have a responsibility, but I do think that our districts and our higher ed institutions have a responsibility to partner with our districts to provide that professional development and create those learning communities for teachers. I think that if we can help teachers understand sort of this, what Michelle was sort of teasing me a little bit earlier about, I sort of really dig into the difference between transactional and transformational generative AI. So in a professional development training I did for Waco ISD, K-12 teachers on generative AI, tried to help them see a transaction would be, okay, I have a Basenji, okay? If I want to teach a lesson plan on a Basenji, I enter in the input into ChatGPT, give me a lesson plan with three learning outcomes and an assessment and an activity to do on the African Basenji, okay? It spits it out, I look at it, I say, okay, that's it, and I just take it and I use it. I use the output as is. I don't analyze it. I don't critique it. I don't make any changes to it. That's transactional. We don't want teachers doing that because we want them to have that human in the loop aspect of it, right? Where they're thinking about what's best for my students. What do they need? Who are they? What are their characteristics? But if they know how to get that input, do that input and get that output and then analyze it and critique it and transform it to have appropriate use for their classrooms, then I think that that's really powerful. And when I showed them the differences between those two and how to actually take those lessons plans and transform them and make them their own, they said this was going to change your life. So I think it comes down to, I mean, I'm in higher ed, so I like the higher ed K-12 partnerships, but you don't need higher ed to do this. Just having really solid teacher professional development and targeting their self-efficacy, I think, is really helpful. That's my take on the K-12 question.
Just one quick piece is there is going to be fear. It's also a place of vulnerability, right? We're experts in our field. We have degrees in our area, in our specialty areas. This is an entirely new world for so many of us. And so it is natural that there is a gap of enthusiasm to jump into something that you are completely learning from the ground up. And so to echo Julie's point is the professional learning is so important because it helps tame some of those fears. And I don't ever want you to lose that fear because the fear is what actually helps us. So use the fear. It helps us approach things with caution and strategy instead of just jumping into the deep end. And so being able to engage with your digital community, engage with your fellow university and your state of Texas and beyond is really important, because that support network, we're all living the same experience right now together, again, right? We've done this with the pandemic, now we're doing this one more time. This is not going to be the last disruption we have in higher education, and we know that. And so just really leaning into that fear, but more than anything, that professional network that you already have in place, reach out. We love to have conversations over these pieces. I discover something new every time that I, thank you for inviting me, come to institutions, because this is what makes all of us stronger. And so the more that we can talk about it, the more we're going to gain from it.
I think we have time for one more quick question. I don't know who has the mic.
And right, we've got right here.
Yeah, sure. Hi.
So I really love the words you used, fear. So I'm thinking about the hopes and fear exercise. So definitely there's a lot of things to be hopeful for. But one of my biggest fears, and it's not just mine, like I've heard it in the community among many people, is whatever we do, that we don't do it in a way that it removes the joy from learning, mm-hmm. from face-to-face interactions, yeah. from doing things like using a pen and like learning how to write mm-hmm. on a piece of paper, or doing formulas. It takes longer, but learning how to make mistakes, building resiliency, mm-hmm. having like nonverbal communication. So how do we embrace it in a way, and we know when to push back to say, it may make us more efficient, but it removes that joy, the resilience, that humanity part from us?
That's a great question. And I think it is individual for each person who teaches. But I think it really does come down to understanding that learning outcome and what you want students to know and be able to do, and being able to motivate them and help them understand when and where this wouldn't be useful. Personally, I think that, you know, I know that this is an old phrase, and we think a lot about in academic affairs and the ways that using generative AI might actually be able to help us have sort of a redux of the flipped classroom, where we start to take the things that don't really need to happen face to face, right, where students really don't need us, that can be done more efficiently offline, and have that time for that in-person, face-to-face work, that social collaboration, social learning with peers, and active mastery with us, seeing us and engaging with us face-to-face in the places that they really need it. So I think that's where the hope is for me, is that we don't lose that joy because we're actually more efficient in that face-to-face time than we are right now. Well, thank you, everyone. Thank you so much, David and Michelle. We'll be up here for a few minutes. Thank you so much for spending your afternoon with us.
Thank you.
For a full recap of policy leadership in the age of AI, including more panel audio, coverage from our exclusive keynote conversation with Dr. Alondra Nelson on AI and policymaking, and photos from the events, go to the news section on our website, lbj.utexas.edu. And be sure to follow us on LinkedIn and Instagram @TheLBJ School. This is Policy on Purpose. Thank you for listening.